Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are in San Francisco with Walter Truitt Anderson. I like stories. I have always liked stories. And it turns out that you have given me a rationale for why I like stories. Would you please put all these changes you are talking about in the context, if you will, of the female experience? Because it seems to me, as I read your stuff, that's a complimentary stuff, women, in some ways, represent what you're talking about, don't they?
Yeah, I think. Let me answer that in a couple of ways, hopefully without getting myself into too much trouble in the process. It seems to me that the women who are at least positively involved in change and changing the rules of the gender and what they can do are kind of a vanguard in the sense that they have to be aware of some of the issues. They have to recognize that social roles, for example, are socially constructed and are not chiseled in stone for all time. And it's not at all surprising to me that a lot of the most accessible theoretical work in postmodern thought and in what we call constructivism is done by women.
As outsiders or as thinkers, or did we just get lucky?
As thinkers. I think women tend to see the relevance of these kinds of issues and the immediacy of them and the practicality of them more quickly than men tend to do. And
how do you account for that?
Well, I think women historically have kind of suspected that the rules they lived by were sort of made up by somebody, you know.
And they tended to be quite efficient for the people making up the rules.
Mm-hmm. But it comes, the idea, for example, of what they call context dependency comes out of women's psychology, out of feminist theory. And it essentially says that what we are is always dependent on the context we're in. And that may seem kind of obvious or sound kind of obvious to us, but as a matter of fact, a fair amount of psychology and a fair amount of our ethical and moral assumptions have been that you were supposed to be the same person all the time. And if you weren't, you were either kind of wishy-washy or you were dishonest.
Or crazy.
Or had a mental disorder.
A mental disorder. And women have been arguing for some time now that, in a sense, to be mentally healthy is to be good at being context dependent, and that women have been context dependent and just could kind of roll with the changes, you know, marry one guy, go off to his wherever his business takes him, learn to fit in, etc., come home.
Yeah, and you're not necessarily saying that's biological, but you are saying that they've had a lot of practice at that, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, it may also be biological.
I don't know. Who knows?
But at the very least, they have practice.
And I noticed that a lot of the, you mentioned stories that seem to me to most dramatically demonstrate some of the issues about identity are stories told about women. I think the first one was that really kind of got through to me was when a woman who I know who's a psychotherapist talked about a young woman who came to her as a client and was feeling terribly stressed and said, I just feel terribly dishonest. And the young woman said that the basic situation was that she was a student and that on the campus she was kind of a radical feminist, and that periodically she'd go home to her little town in the Midwest, and whenever she did that, she would kind of begin to respond to all those cues and expectations and memories and things like that, and kind of regress into being this little kind of boopsy teenager that she'd been in high school, and really feel herself kind of turning into a different person. And she felt deeply hypocritical and deeply concerned because he wasn't too sure which one of those was her. And the therapist said, "Where do you feel most like yourself?" You know, she said, "On the airplane." But I think that there is
But that's not a polarity. That's part of why I think that's such an interesting story, is that there are three options.
At least. But that's what we... You see, there's a profound cultural gap involved here to be able to say that it's okay. And there's a lot of kind of personal skills to be learned in integrating that into your life, and to be able to say it's okay to kind of move around from one culture to the next, as a lot of people do these days, you know.
In a sense, this sounds like what we're talking about is a sense of absolute limits on the power of reason to address the world. That there are things that are just very hard to get your hands around, which sounds like where you start at least one of your books with the Enlightenment, which was predicated essentially. It's interesting. Edward E. L. Wilson maintains that the Enlightenment failed more or less right out of the gate.
E. L. Wilson is a biologist.
That it promised more in terms, particularly of dealing with the spiritual side, than it could deliver, and it collapsed more or less instantaneously in the face of the French Revolution, essentially. Your view, and it's one that I'm more familiar with, is that we are running that string out now. But in whichever case, the argument is that there are things that are not reachable solely on the basis of purely rational thought.
Well, that may be, but at the same time, I don't really give up. I don't think we've really reached the limits of rational
thought. We haven't tried it.
And the trouble with the Enlightenment, as is often the case with human projects, is that they thought it was easier than it turned out to be, and that they were going to establish some rules, and everybody would say, aha, I get it, and then think clearly and ask the right questions and agree with one another on the answers achieved thereby. Well, it turns out that the human mind is a good deal more complex than that, and what the brain guys now tell us is that we probably have three or four different versions of reality running somewhere in our skulls at any given time, and that we are kind of a chorus of voices that is still incapable of thinking rationally, you see.
Incapable or capable?
Capable. Mm-hmm. But that rational thought process is much more complex and multidimensional and multi-layered than the Enlightenment guys thought it was going to be.
There was also, I think, my view is that the Enlightenment, you can sort of date from the publication of Newton's Principia Mathematica, the mathematical formalization.
Which was before 1967.
Yes, it was. It was about 300 years ago. That created essentially mathematical formalisms by which to describe planetary motion and other kinds of motion, mm-hmm. and was just remarkably successful. And its progeny has been very successful in our ability to physically manipulate the world around us. The technology that we're so proud of, and it is a major factor in this identity crisis, I think, of which you speak, is dated from that. And it is, in many ways, talking about language, it has redefined the language that we use to apply to the world around us, that this mathematical formalism and the ability to not only make rational arguments, but to demonstrate mathematically a solution, and then to have that solution demonstrated in any context.
Yes.
Powerful stuff.
Strong medicine.
Strong medicine for sure. And I can remember the college days when people used to say that mathematics was more or less the equivalent of reality and the way the universe worked. Since then, we've got books like Good Alicia Buck, for example, that point out that mathematics itself is a language. Which
That's
is
Douglas Hofstadter.
Yes, that has its internal inconsistencies and is a pretty good representation of a whole lot of stuff that goes on out there, but isn't the last word, so to speak. And we know that we still operate all kinds of things on Newtonian principles, but we also have several other layers of physical reality that we recognize to be rationally useful at the same time. So like a lot of things, things get kind of more
richer than
it just the mix gets richer, but it doesn't mean that you discard Newtonian thought or mathematics.
When you talk about all of these different possibilities of reality in one's own head and this larger set of possibilities, that scares a lot of people, and that had the scares has implications internally and externally, doesn't it?
It scares a lot of people, and it seems to cheer up a lot of people. It's been a good 10 years now, I think, since I wrote Reality Isn't What It Used to Be, and have gone around and talked to a lot of people about this in different kinds of gatherings. And I can remember a woman who kind of stood up and said, I just can't deal with this. I just feel like the floor is going to fall out from under me, and I feel sick to my stomach. And I can remember another woman of about the same age who started jumping up and down and laughing because she felt this great sense of liberation. As she began to get a sense of her own power in relation to truth and falsehood, for example.
This is Dr. Walter Truett Anderson. He is with Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, here in San Francisco. We're all going to return in just a moment. Please do be with us.